This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Michael Monks. In his new book, It's Up to Us, former Ohio Governor John Kasich explores leadership and how individuals can rise up to make change in their communities. He also writes about being prepared to walk alone in doing so. Last week, Kasich bucked his own party and announced his support for the impeachment of President Trump. Governor John Kasich joins us now live on the phone. Governor, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Michael. Glad to be with you.
Absolutely. And we appreciate your team sending our team the book so that we could take a look at it and prepare for this interview. And we're going to talk about the new book, It's Up to Us. I think I'll start, though, with some of the news that you made last week. You made some news last week when you came out in support of the impeachment process moving against President Trump. You cited acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney's apparent admission that military aid for Ukraine was held up by the administration in order to provoke this investigation into Democrats. And that was the last straw for you. Can you take us to that moment for you, what you were feeling when you heard that statement and realized what your position would be?
Well, my heart sunk when I heard that because, you know, this is not my sweet spot, you know, scandal investigations. I don't like anything having to do with it. But I have been, you know, in the public eye for quite a long time. And, you know, people have asked me over and over on television, you know, I do a lot of things with CNN. And I just felt that as I followed this very, very carefully, meticulously, that I had said all along that there should be an investigation, let the chips fall where they may. But at the end, there has to be something along a quid pro quo. And then, you know, the chief of staff says there was a quid pro quo. And I couldn't figure out how I would just dismiss that. And I felt that it was, it just rose to the level where, you know, we have to move forward with this. And so it wasn't easy. There's no joy in it for me. I just, you know, I felt like I had to be true to myself. It's not any more complicated than that, but I'm still not happy about it, but it is what it is.
Since then, Mick Mulvaney has tried to walk back that statement. Has that attempt influenced your position at all?
No. I think he gave us a clear window into the way in which they were operating. And, you know, I don't want to pound on him. I noticed I didn't even mention his name. I don't want to. It's just that, it wasn't so much a misstep or a slip or something like that. I think it was more of a window into the way in which they operated. And, I think he got all revved up at the press conference and, you know, he was like, you know, this is what we do and, you know, get over it, that kind of thing. So yeah, of course he'd be trying to walk it back, and it just, that doesn't hold water with me.
You're familiar with the impeachment process. You were in the Congress representing Ohio when President Bill Clinton faced impeachment in the House. I'm wondering your thoughts on this impeachment process. If it fully plays out and there's a trial in the Senate, what does justice look like to you?
Well, first of all, I think that the Democrats need to have a vote on an impeachment inquiry, and I don't like the fact that they won't do it. And I think it's fundamentally for political reasons. And that is not, you know, no, there should be no politics in the middle of this. I don't want to be projecting the future, but if it goes over to the Senate, all I'm going to say is they just need to look at the articles of impeachment and look at the evidence and make a determination.
The name of your book is It's Up to Us. And early in this writing, you argue that a president helps to set the national tone and conversation, and that tone could be inclusive, supportive, and aspirational, or negative, divisive, and incendiary. So in that respect, in commenting upon the current president, Donald Trump, how do you think he has affected the national tone and conversation?
Well, we know the answer to that. He's just terrible. And that's why, you know, the last book I wrote was about this. The last book was about the fact that the reason why I couldn't go with him is because, you know, he was divisive. And, you know, I just saw the other day, and I'm not blaming this on him, but you have somebody, apparently, allegedly, who is a Trump supporter, putting bear spray on a bunch of people who were protesting Trump. I mean, the problem is that people are just so down in their silos and so locked in and so worked up. But I believe you got to have a healer. You know, I ran the state of Ohio. I mean, in the beginning of my term, you know, we had a very, very ugly development when I was out there trying to figure out how to rein in some of the costs we had with local governments, and it didn't work. And I learned from it and realized that, you know, as a leader, I had to, I mean, sometimes you got to stand up and sometimes you're going to divide, but you try to avoid it as much as you can. And you try to bring people together and give everybody a sense of opportunity and hopefulness. And, you know, he has not done that. And I was hoping that he would, but, you know, he hasn't done it.
Your book is laid out in 10 sections that offer a sort of guide for reclaiming power as an individual and what to do with that to affect change. And you start with this message. The first principle is to start a movement. And you talk about how power flows up. And you use the example of Greta Thunberg, the Swedish teen climate change activist. She recently spoke at the United Nations. Would you say that Greta Thunberg inspires you?
Oh, well, I mean, I think what's happened is she's so cool because, and there's a lesson here, all she did was to stand out in front of the parliament every day, skipping school because she felt so strongly about protecting the earth. And then she decided she'd just do it on Fridays, and she started a global movement. It just shows that just standing up and standing for things really matters. And so, you know, she created a global movement. See, the whole point of this book is to say to people, stop wringing your hands about things that happen in faraway places and start figuring out how to get your power back. But let me give you a story that I just found the other day that I think is delightful. There was a woman who got in a car accident. Apparently, as best I could tell, she had her daughter in the car. And when the police came to figure out the accident and everything, the little girl was sitting outside and she was hysterical. And the fireman that showed up on the scene saw this young lady, and she was holding a bottle of fingernail polish. And I guess both of them had daughters, and they went over to her and asked her about the fingernail polish. And then they asked, would she paint their fingernails? Which she then proceeded to do. And in the process, she calmed down. She got her composure back. And then the firemen held up their fingers so everybody could see. Is a really, really sweet story. Those things, you know, just doing little things like that changed the world. Changed that little girl's world, I'll tell you that. And those firemen felt fantastic about what happened. So this book is about not only the big things that one can do, but the little things that one can do. As Martin Luther King said, if you can't do great things, then do small things in a great way. I buy that.
Throughout this book, you share anecdotes like that and stories that you've encountered or read about. I'm wondering, you know, you've spent a lot of time as a politician where you're getting to know people and possibly looking for stories to use to influence policy or to feature when you're speaking. I'm wondering, when you talk about seeing that example of the girl with the firefighters, are you seeing things as more of an author now? Or are you seeing ways to tell these stories differently than you've used before?
Maybe. You know, it's funny. I wrote a book. This is my fifth book. The first one was called Courage is Contagious, and I wrote it in the late 90s. And it is a story about these, you know, ordinary people who did extraordinary things. And I was talking to a lady who's worked on all my books with me yesterday. I said, you know, it's sort of similar to what we did before. She said, yeah, but now you've given them a direction, a prescription as to how they can get their power back. And so, you know, this has been something that I have thought about, you know, virtually all of my lifetime, because I believe in the power of individuals to make a difference. And I want people to be optimistic and hopeful about, you know, their lives. And, you know, look, it's all great stuff. It's noble, you know, but, you know, I'm not that great a guy. I'm just doing the best I can, one foot in front of the other. And, you know, I never kind of thought of myself as a politician. You know, I was just a public servant trying to do my job. And I don't know. What can I tell you? I never thought I would be writing. I would have written five books in my lifetime. It's just crazy, but it's fun.
And we're talking now with former Ohio Governor John Kasich, who has a new book called It's Up to Us. Also in this book, you write about some other young people, the students who survived the deadly shooting at Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. And you note that they were somewhat of an inspiration to Greta Thunberg as well. You write about how these young people were able to band together to impact the conversation on gun rights and gun control. And I'm wondering how those Parkland students and I guess other tragedies, survivors of recent gun violence in this country may have impacted or influenced you as someone who had been endorsed as a politician by the National Rifle Association, but who later tried to pass stricter regulations and to adopt what we know as red flag laws.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've been all over the place on that issue. In 1994, I guess it was, I voted to ban assault weapons and was involved in the crime bill. And then the NRA was against me. You know, they fought me when I ran for governor. And they, fortunately, they did not win. I am a Second Amendment supporter, but I think there's limits to it. That's all. And a red flag law, the idea that somebody who is, you know, mentally unstable, and the fact that we can't seem to go and figure out how to take their gun away so they don't hurt themselves. And think about this story that just happened with that coach that saved that one boy. Did you hear about this?
I'm not sure.
That boy showed up with a shotgun. And they're not going to really throw the book at this kid because he had a mental illness. So a red flag law simply goes to help people who, you know, who would otherwise might even harm themselves to not have not harm themselves. And, you know, I couldn't get this thing passed. And the reason I couldn't get it passed is also illustrated by the power of the kids at Parkland, because they wouldn't take no for an answer. And they put so much pressure on the legislators down in Florida that they passed some reasonable gun restrictions. In Ohio, we just couldn't get anybody to march. You know, we couldn't get people to show up, and that became a problem.
And that seems to be the same thing that we're hearing from your successor, Governor Mike DeWine, who's put out a bill for the legislature to consider. I understand this piece of legislation will start out in the Senate there, but he's come out and said, you have to present something that will get through the legislature. What do you think needs to happen for the legislature to shift its position on this issue?
Oh, people have to make it clear to them that you better be voting for these reasonable things. And if you don't, you know, then you know, I'm not going to support you. I mean, it's public pressure that works. You know, that's what works. And so where I failed was I couldn't get 10,000 people to show up on the grounds of the State House. If you get 10,000 people to show up on the grounds of the State House demanding change on guns, those people will pass it so fast and make your head spin. And I'm not talking about taking away people's guns, but reasonable things, like figuring out who's buying them, you know, or taking them away from somebody who's unstable. This is not radical stuff, but the people who oppose these things are very loud, and it scares these legislators.
I'm going to bounce around a little in the order of the 10 sections that you lay out your book. And one section that interests me as a student of communication, it's dedicated to silos and how we need to get out of our own personal silos of information. And then you have this other section that's about being the change where you live. And I'm coupling them together because they strike me as being somewhat related. But first, do you see today's information silos, their vastness, their reach, and perhaps their adherence to a particular agenda as a danger to this effort to empower the individual?
No. I think that all this information is good. We can pick and choose what we believe. And what I try to say to people is, if you want to be interesting as a person, everybody wants to be interesting, that's just natural to us, get out of your silo. Could be a little scary at first. I mean, I've had conversations with people where I have told them things that were clearly facts, and they looked at me like I'd come from Mars, something that they didn't agree with. But they had never thought about it. They thought, you know, what I was saying was, are you kidding me? And I just had one the other day. I can't remember exactly what it was. But I noticed that sometimes people are like, I didn't know that. You know, how could that be? So it's important that we get out of our silos on the social issues and political issues of the day. But it's also important that we get out of our silos and explore things that you know, that we might not initially have an interest in. Like, I've got a friend who's now in the bee business. He's trying to make honey with these beehives, and He's told me about the way these organisms work, and I mean, it's interesting, you know. And what I find is the more I know about things, the more interesting I become, I think, to people around me, and the more I expand my brain. And that's what we ought to be doing all of our lives, is absorbing more and more things. It's really important.
But do you not see a danger in some of the information that we are absorbing, if it's inaccurate, if it's disingenuous, if it's disinformation, if it's designed to mislead us and to confuse us, and because of all the different outlets that we have?
Well, you know, I think that people are pretty smart, and over time they figure out what the truth is. That's where the alternative to that is censorship, and I don't believe that, because that means that somebody is going to be deciding for me, and I don't like that. I actually thought that Zuckerberg made a good statement about what they want to do with Facebook and the way in which way they want information to be spread and let people decide what they believe and what they don't believe. I used to think that on college campuses that there was some reasonable limit to who should be invited to speak. And then I had a great conversation with Gordon Gee, the former president of Ohio State, current president of WVU. He says, John, let them speak. Let them get and speak, and, you know, let it get out there. And I think that's important, and he convinced me of it. And that's kind of how I feel.
You have some experience in multiple media opportunities. You hosted a show for a long time on Fox News, Heartland with John Kasich, and now you're contributing to CNN. I'm wondering, you know, there's a lot of criticism that's hurled at all those cable news outlets, CNN, Fox, MSNBC, for a variety of different reasons, from a variety of different ideologies, along with all those online outlets, too. I'm wondering, when you think at all about your time as a host, post your congressional career and being in the media business, do you look back and think that you would have conducted your show differently, or that you missed any opportunities to change the way media is presented?
No, I like what I don't really have many regrets in my life. The biggest regret, I guess I would say I have, is that when I was 12 years old, I got hit by a fast-pitched baseball, and it scared the living daylights out of me. And I've often thought about the fact that I could have probably played them. I know I could have played for the Reds. I mean, they need players. And so my only regret is that I feared the baseball.
Oh, wow.
In all seriousness, I just don't have any regrets. When I was at Fox News, I hosted Bill O'Reilly's show when he was gone for 7 or 8 years. I had my own two shows. I liked the way it was. We used to debate all the time. It was very hard. Now, you know, I'm at CNN, and I'm a commentator. I think my voice is unique on that at that network, and people have never tried to tell me what to say. And what they always say is they like me because they think I'm, I'm authentic. I mean, I'm just trying to be myself. So there's nothing there that I would that I would take back. Listen, there's two other things I'd like to mention about the book. And one is the idea, when people are listening, you're special. Everybody listening is special. No one's ever been like you, and no one will ever be like you again. And that means that you have a mission. And in order to determine that mission, sometimes in life we need to slow down. We need to unplug. We need to just go out and take a walk, or, you know, look at the scenery around us. Don't go so fast, and then you can figure out what it is you're supposed to do. And at length to that is really the concept that, you know, nobody's getting out of this place alive. That, you know, life is short, and we have an eternal destiny. I happen to believe it. I wrote a book on faith. That was my third book, and I loved it. And that book is still pretty popular, and I don't try to shove my faith on anybody else's throat, but the need to consider our eternal destiny and the meaning of life is for everyone out there. And what I like about this book is it's a book for the young, it's a book for the middle-aged, and it's a book for our seniors.
Because we
should never stop living a life bigger than ourselves.
Those are sections 9 and 10 in your book, number 9 being to spend some time examining your eternal destiny. So when you do that, are there any visions of another White House run?
No. when I do that, I just try, I mean, to be honest, I just try to put myself, do my thing, work as hard as I can, be smart about what I'm doing. But at the end, my future is in the hands of the big guy. And that's how I look at it. And as a result of that, most times I feel very, very free in my life, and I can do what I want or say what I want. You know, so I take this position on the president, and it's not comfortable. But, you know, it's okay. If people are going to yell at me, which some did on the radio the other day, that's okay. I'm cool with that. I just have to kind of be true to myself. But I have to also say, I will put myself down with all the people listening as the number one hypocrite, me. I'm deeply flawed. It's just I can get up the next day and maybe try to do a little better.
Governor, I know you got to run, but I hope you'll indulge me for one last thing. When you were governor,
sure,
you spent a lot of time working with the governor of Kentucky at the time on the Brent Spence Bridge. We still don't have that project moving forward. I'm wondering, now that you're out of office, if you have any advice that might be worthy for Governor DeWine and Governor Matt Bevin, or possibly another Governor Beshear coming up behind him based on what happens in a couple of weeks.
You know, I think that one thing that governors or governors-to-be don't want is for somebody to just volunteer their opinion. If those governors wanted to get my opinion, they'd call me. I try to stay out of this stuff. But it's very disappointing. It was ideology that didn't allow this to happen. The bridge gets more dangerous. The bridge gets more expensive. It's just ridiculous, absolutely absurd. And I think they're looking for some miracle to come about, which I don't think is coming. I don't think Washington's going to bail them out. And by the way, when we're like $22 trillion in the hole, I mean, how much more do we want to take from our kids? All they got to do is toll that bridge, get this thing done, and go about it. So, you know, what can I tell you? We did our job. We have to see what they do in the state next door. What can I tell you? They ought to get the basketball coach Calipari down there at the University of Kentucky. His team's now ranked number 2 in the country, and he'd get it done, I guarantee you. He's a Pittsburgh boy, and he would get it done. Hey, I so enjoyed being with you today, and thank you for paying attention to all my friends in the Cincinnati area and all over, wherever they're all listening. God bless you, and think about how you can live a life a little bigger than yourself.
Governor, we appreciate your time so much. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Bye.
Governor John Kasich joining us here on Cincinnati Edition to talk about his new book, It's Up to Us. You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show is Elise Meckler. The assistant producer is Selena Reeder. The technical director is Josh Elstro. Subscribe to our podcast at WVXU.org. I'm Michael Monks.